Sports Illustrated's NBA Show, breaking down the latest news, rumors, and everything in between. Here's your host, Chris Mannix and Rohan Nadkarni.
And we are back. Crossover NBA podcast. Chris Mannix joined this week by Rohan Nadkarni, who is anxiously awaiting Denver Nuggets Miami Heat finals to make its way to the shores of South Beach. I was in Ball Arena last night, Rohan, and as we both know, I've become something of an enemy to the Nuggets fans. And I did, you know, sometimes you wonder about Twitter and just what kind of reach it has. So I did kind of wonder as I took my media seat, which was on the first level, like if anyone would say anything to me about kind of my critiques of not even critiques, but like my statements about the level of interest people have in the Nuggets. And sure enough, like I sit down in the first row and directly in front of me, this guy kind of turns around, eyeballs me, and I see him say to his friends, "That's Chris Mannix." He said, "We're the most boring team ever." And I'm like, all right, this has now graduated to a whole different level. But shout out to those guys. They turned around. We had a little bit of fun with it during the course of the game. And
I was going to ask, like, you have to walk around with a bodyguard situation? You have to take an armored car from your hotel straight to the arena?
No, I got to media day on Wednesday, chatted with Vic Lombardi, chatted mm-hmm. with some of the other Nuggets people. Like we're arguing over sports. So ultimately It's not, you know.
I'm surprised Michael Malone hasn't dropped it in a press conference yet. That's the biggest upset of the finals so far.
I've known Michael Malone for mm-hmm. a long time. As I said, I think I said to you when this all kind of broke out, like I'm working with the Nuggets and Michael Malone on something mm-hmm. That will run down the line. He's a great guy. He's obviously been using this no respect card as a motivational ploy. Like that's been part of it. So yeah, to me, I'm a little bit surprised. I haven't been eyeballed at least once or twice at these press conferences. I will say this, like, you know, I think it was somewhere in the first half during a timeout on the Jumbotron in Ball Arena, they did this skit where the Nuggets mascot was chasing down the voices of people criticizing the team and, mm-hmm. you know, and then they had the mascot like beating up on a television and beating up on like a radio or just like, all right, I mean, Maybe it's time to let it go.
Dude,
time to move on.
They are getting so much mileage out of this disrespect card. And it's just getting a little out of hand. Again,
it's now officially out of hand.
I told Michael Malone that I picked the Nuggets to win the finals. Okay, he's conveniently left that out of the narrative. I told him that in Los Angeles. So it's funny to me how much they're kind of beating this dead horse. Like, okay, you know, if you get a first take segment, all of a sudden you're not going to be like the world's most favorite team. It's just a very funny storyline that they've ginned up.
Well, look, both these teams have played kind of the disrespect card. I thought our colleague Tanya Ganguly had a good story in the New York Times on Friday, you know, talking about the championship of disrespect mm-hmm. in a way between these two teams. But as we've said before, you cannot be disrespected when you have a star who, by the national media, was voted a two-time MVP. It just doesn't work that way. They are respected. They are not covered as much as other teams are. And that's what really this boils down to, that, you know, Nuggets fans are not necessarily looking for reporting, but they're looking for patronage. They want to mm-hmm. turn on ESPN and hear people talking about how Jamal Murray is now a top 10 player and not, is Anthony Davis still mm-hmm. a top 10 player? I did think that screen grab going around of Stephen A. Smith not putting Nikola Jokic on his list of supermax guys. I mean, look, that's a little disrespectful. Yeah. I mean, Nikola Jokic is absolutely worthy of every nickel that he's been paid. He proved that in game one.
Also, I just want to say the Miami Heat, if anything, were over-respected because everyone coming into the playoffs was like, the Heat are dangerous. And it's like, this team had a negative point differential. Okay, they were not disrespected. They were straight up below average during the regular season.
They were below average in the first play-in game when they got smoked by Atlanta on their own court. So it's all what you choose to believe and how you choose to interpret it. But game one on Thursday night, obviously I was there. Tremendous atmosphere, tremendous experience, and it was just an outstanding performance mm-hmm. by Denver. it was a largely drama-free, complete execution of their opponent. And it was done in very Nuggets-y type ways, which is to say it wasn't their best player going out and dominating from start to finish. It was a combination of things. You had Aaron Gordon scoring 12 points in the first quarter. You had Jamal Murray scoring 26 points on 22 shots. Michael Porter Jr., who did not shoot the ball well, 5 for 16, but finding ways to impact the game in other ways. I think he had, what, 13 rebounds
in
that game? Yeah, a couple of blocks. Not a guy not known for his defense, played pretty good defense on the perimeter when you had Max Strus go 0 for 10 and Caleb Martin go 1 for 7. Miami's just not going to win a lot of games when those two guys are shooting like that. And then when they needed somebody to take over the game in the fourth quarter, when Miami made kind of one of those quasi runs to cut the lead to 9 at one point, you had Jokic take over. And he had 12 points in the fourth and was just dominant. You know, I thought this was the game, Rohan, that Miami needed to steal. To have any chance to win the series, they had to win game one. Denver was off for 10 days. Miami was sharp coming off that series against Boston. I'm sure a little tired from that as well. But, you know, this was their chance, in my opinion, to get a game. And they didn't do it. They didn't do it because Denver continues to be just elite. They continue to be the best team in the NBA. So that was kind of my takeaway. You saw the Nuggets just be the Nuggets and be the team we've seen really since the start of the second round of the playoffs. What did you see?
Yeah, you know, I picked Denver to win this series in five, and this kind of confirmed, game one at least confirmed why. It's just they execute at such a high level that even when Miami, for example, you mentioned they make that quasi run in the fourth quarter, and is Denver a little threatened? It just feels like the Nuggets can get a good shot on offense whenever they really put their mind to it. And that's the feeling I got in game one. You know, the Heat in the fourth quarter turned up the defense a little bit. Jokic sat for a few minutes. But I just saw Denver through three quarters, especially executing at such a high level offensively. They have so much talent and so many different ways to hurt the Heat. You mentioned Aaron Gordon taking advantage of switches in the first quarter, kind of dominating the paint against smaller Miami players. So then Miami says, okay, Jimmy Butler's saying on Aaron Gordon, we're not going to give up the switch. That leads to defensive miscommunications elsewhere. You have other guys getting to the rim, getting to the three-point line. You mentioned how this was a game Miami was supposed to steal. Even with the Heat's three-point shooting struggles, they outshot Denver from the three-point line. They had fewer turnovers than the Nuggets. So there were things that happened in that game that could be a quote-unquote recipe for Heat success. The fact they were still not able to win, I think, is pretty concerning. I do think on the flip side, Miami should be generally happy with its offensive process. I think they got a lot of open shots, not just from three. Jimmy Butler was, I think, 2 of 9 outside of the restricted area in game one. Those are shots he's been hitting over the course of the playoffs. So I wouldn't say, again, I picked Denver to win this series handily, but I do think if you squint, there's some hope for Miami.
All right. I don't disagree with that because, you know, in the fourth quarter and the second half, I guess, total, the fourth quarter, though, they outscored Denver 30-20. But in the second half total, Miami sort of figured a couple of things out. I'm not entirely sure how transferable that's going to be because I also think Denver's going to play better in game two. I think they shot sub 30% from three-point range, and that's probably going to be a better number going into game two. I think Miami's biggest problem is that all the junk defenses they've thrown at teams throughout the playoffs, all the things that have made them successful, it's just probably not going to be as successful against Denver because Denver has Nikola Jokic, who is not going to force shots in traffic. He's going to do what he did in the first half. First quarter, I think he had like a few points, 3 or 4, but he also had 6 assists.
6 assists, nuts.
Yeah, first half, he had 10 assists. So, like, you're not going to trick him into, you know, making irrational plays. He's just such a smart player and unselfish player that he's always going to do the right thing. There, on the other side of the ball, too, there was this clip going around I saw on Twitter over the course of the day. And it was late in the game, and Jokic was at the free throw line. I don't know if you saw this, but Jokic was at the free throw line. And as he's standing there waiting to take his second shot, he looks over at the Miami bench and hears their play call. And he turns around. It's a pistol play call. So he turns around, puts his hand up in the air, makes the pistol motion to his bench. His bench gets his guys in line, and Miami turned the ball over in a possession that effectively put the game out of reach.
Right.
Like, this guy is as smart a player as there is in the NBA. He just always makes the right play, and he's always out there you know, thinking the game through on every possession. It really was remarkable to watch him against a really good defensive team, a defensive team that builds its defenses around making you think as much as possible. Watching Jokic just dissect it was really incredible to see.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's funny. You mentioned he didn't conventionally dominate the game in the sense that he didn't score 50 points, which he's also done before in the playoffs. But he, as you said, he dominated it with his mind. He can pick you apart. There's a tweet. It was kind of funny. It was like the Heat are finally playing an offense that knows how to pass the ball. It's like the Heat are just
wrong.
Yeah, the Heat are just, this is a whole different class of offensive opponent than what Miami has seen so far in the playoffs. I mean, the Bucks are famously a bad half-court team. The Knicks were good offensively during the regular season, but Julius Randle, not really a player anyone's scared of in the playoffs. They kind of become a one-man show. Boston, we know, has its issues, over-reliance on the three-point line, etc. Denver, it's a completely different beast. And Cooper Moorhead, who writes for Heat.com, had these stats. Denver was 1.16 points per possession versus the zone, 1.15 points per possession versus man defense. No matter what Miami did, Denver had an answer for it. And I think the Heat are in such a tricky spot because not only there's just no coverage for Jokic, and beyond that, even if there was a magical coverage, does Miami have the size or personnel to execute it? I don't know. So one thing that would help them, you know, offensively, if they make some of those shots early, it at least allows them to get their defense set, which isn't a magical solve, but gives them a chance against Denver. But the degree to which they miss shots and allow Denver to kind of get out and run, attack mismatches in semi-transition, you're going to have no shot to win that way. But Chris, I came away from this game thinking two things. One, which is, how did Phoenix win two games against the Nuggets without Chris Paul? And two, what is the NBA, the other 29 teams, have to be thinking, at least the Western Conference, what are we going to do about Jokic and Murray in the playoffs? Because I haven't seen a single good answer yet.
No, there's none. When you have a guy that is as unselfish as Jokic and guys around him that are willing, if not eager, to step into their roles, you're going to be successful. I thought Michael Malone made a great point after the game when he was talking about Aaron Gordon. Aaron Gordon's willingness to take on a lesser role this year. Remember, Gordon last year, he was terrific. He got to play a bigger offensive role because Murray was out and Porter Jr. was largely out. This year, both those guys are back. Gordon's got to slide into more of a defensive-minded role. Still put up his number, still was a borderline all-star. But you know, his willingness to adapt to the team around him, it's a winning player. He's just a winning player. They've got a lot of guys on that team that you would describe as winning players. Really, the only thing you hope for right now is some kind of injury affects them, because they do. And we'll get into this. If and when they win a championship, we'll get into kind of the dynasty potential, but they do have dynasty potential.
Yes,
they have
agreed.
Warriors kind of potential down the line. But I don't want to write off Miami yet, because we constantly write Miami off. We wrote them off after they lost to Atlanta. They beat Chicago, get into the playoffs, did everything that they did. Spoelstra's going to have adjustments. He's going to figure some things out. He's going to throw some new things at the Nuggets. But they can't win without Caleb Martin playing like the guy he did in the Eastern Conference Finals. They can't win without Max Strus shooting an efficient number with his shots. When you watch that game, do you see opportunities that were missed for those guys? I mean, you know, both these guys were such difference makers in the Eastern Conference playoffs. To see them go a combined, what, one for 17?
Yeah,
in that game, that was pretty wild to see.
Yeah, I saw a couple things offensively for Miami that I thought were interesting. It's funny, I think after the game, Michael Malone said, "We'll live with contested Bam twos." And I was like, were
you
they
do.
Really? But I don't know that they were contested.
Like, the problem Boston ran into, though, like, Boston sent too many double teams at Jimmy Butler. Like,
yeah.
I kept saying during that run, like, you're not going to lose a game on Jimmy Butler twos. Like, you're just not. If he has to shoot, like, 36 shots to get 50 points, you're going to probably survive all that. So, you know, whether or not those shots were contested by Bam Adebayo, you're going to live with that, because you're going to win a lot of games with Bam Adebayo shooting mid-range jumpers.
I agree. I just think it's funny because I don't think Denver was necessarily contesting these shots. I think Miami was finding pockets of space offensively against Denver's drop defense. Bam, that mid-range paint jumper was his shot this year, and Denver gave him a lot of space on it. They gave Jimmy Butler a lot of space and drop coverage at times. He just wasn't able to take advantage. You mentioned Caleb Martin and Max Strus. I mean, Strus going 0 for 9 from 3. I don't know if his legs were tired after the Boston series. The Heat claim, you know, they played the series on top of Mount Everest. And I understand they don't. It's a mindset thing for them. They don't want to use the altitude as an excuse. But you just have to wonder if his legs were getting used to it, because every single one of his shots was off. I also think a big kind of, not storyline, but fascinating quirk from this game, Miami taking only 2 free throws, those coming from Haywood Highsmith. To me, that was a direct result of the Heat taking the space Denver was giving them and shooting jump shots as opposed to attacking the rim. Butler mentioned after the game, it's on me. I need to attack the rim. I agree. I thought he had several opportunities to go up strong at the rim. You know, that time he got blocked by Michael Porter Jr. Jimmy likes to play to the glass a lot. He favors his right hand a lot. I think there are times where he needs to go straight line drive at the rim, test Jokic, test Porter, see if you can get these guys in foul trouble. I think that's their best bet offensively. Kind of really slow the game down, put it in the mud, as they like to say. I was baffled at the number of times it felt like Jimmy could have attacked Jokic at the rim and chose not to. I think Jeff Van Gundy made a comment after one of the times Jokic sat. He was like, Denver doesn't have any shot blocking in the game right now. And I was like, Jeff, Jokic is not a shot blocker. They don't have shot blocking, period, you could argue, unless it's one of their players coming over the weak side. So that's an adjustment. Again, I think Miami, to me, their best bet winning the series, you got to put Jokic in foul trouble. I don't see any other way. Get him off the court, that's your best chance. So
yeah, but when Aaron Gordon's out there, they don't have to send Jokic. They don't have to send much help out there. Aaron Gordon is as good a Butler-level defender as you're going to get. He has size. He has length. He's got good footwork. Like when, you know, to me, and I wrote this on SI.com before the series started, like he was one of the players to watch in this series, because if he can defend Butler and make him inefficient, it's going to be a very fast series, that's for sure. And you look at the numbers, 14 shots for Jimmy Butler, 13 points. That's a great night for Aaron Gordon. Yeah. Great night for Aaron Gordon. So if he can keep that up, we're not going to be talking about this series much more in the next week or so. I don't know what to do with Caleb Martin. Like, Caleb Martin was so good against Boston, found his spots on the floor. He missed some open shots in that game. I thought Miami did win the possession game. They took, 20-some-odd more shots than Denver. So that's a good thing they can hang their hat on. But if Caleb Martin and Max Strus are going 1-for-17, you ain't going to win. Simple as that. It's what it kind of boils down to there. Few things I want to talk about that are happening outside of this series. About an hour or so before we recorded this, you had Frank Vogel reported to be the new head coach of the Phoenix Suns. Vogel taking over for Monty Williams, ending what had been a pretty thorough process for the Suns. That included up to 10 candidates, I believe I was told about that.
Doc Rivers pulled his name out 10 minutes before.
I'm not really sure what to make of that. Doc Rivers was, look, from what
he's
I was...
He's a good coach. I think
he's a good coach. He's a good coach. Yeah. But I do think Doc Rivers should take a year off. Like, I believe he's still getting paid from Philadelphia for the next 2 years. He obviously can do television if he wants to. And when the next job opening comes around, he is going to be a leading candidate for it. You know, Doc Rivers has been coaching for a long time. Goes from Boston to the Clippers to Philadelphia, all without much more than like a week of a break, really. You know, he was basically traded from Boston to L.A. He hopped on a plane from L.A. to go to Philly and took the job there pretty quickly. Now, I know Phoenix is an appealing job, but I think Doc Rivers as a coach and maybe even as a human would benefit, like physically would benefit from taking a year off. He was, from what I was told, Doc Rivers was a favorite of Isaiah Thomas in that mix. And Isaiah Thomas, though not operating in an official capacity, is close with Matt Ishbia. You saw him sitting next to Ishbia at games during the conference finals or conference semifinals. So, you know, that with Isaiah pushing Doc Rivers, it did surprise me a little bit to see Doc Rivers bounced out. I heard Kevin Young's name a lot when I was talking to people involved in all this. Young is a very good young coach. He's a former G League coach. He was on the staff in Phoenix. Got a lot of respect from the players there. I think ultimately Matt Ishbia wanted to go with a proven commodity. And Frank Vogel is a proven commodity. Had a ton of success in Indiana before he left there. won a championship in LA, and I don't care how.
No matter, absurd never, that he lost that job. Absurd that he lost
never,
that job.
You're just never going to look, and this is not a diss on Darvin Ham by any stretch, who was also excellent, but he's not going to convince me that if you gave Frank Vogel the exact same roster Darvin Ham had in the second half of the season, that he wouldn't thrive. Anthony Davis was great under Frank Vogel in that first year. Anthony Davis was great when he was healthy in that second year. He just messed up his body in the playoffs and couldn't finish that out. So Frank Vogel is an excellent coach. I think Frank Vogel, too, is going to be really good with DeAndre Ayton. You know, Vogel historically has been good at coaching big men. You look at what was going on in Indiana when you had Roy Hibbert, you had David West. These guys had some of their most productive years while Frank Vogel was the coach. In L.A., they won a championship in 2020 with two bigs. Dwight Howard was the center. Anthony Davis was the power forward. So I think DeAndre Ayton will benefit from being coached by Frank Vogel. And look, he's a defensive-minded guy. He'll improve that. Like with everything else, it's about the roster. Going into next year, if Chris Paul has nothing left, that's going to be a problem for Phoenix. If they have to turn to campaign to be their starting point guard, that's going to be a problem for Phoenix. But I like the hire of Frank Vogel. I'm sure he's not the splashiest hire that they could make, but I think he is a good fit for what they're trying to do in Phoenix.
I could not agree more. I think we're on the exact same page about what happened with Vogel in Los Angeles, where he was really the victim of bad management by the front office more than anything else. It's crazy. I randomly was on a Phoenix radio show this morning. They were like, do you think Ty Lue is an option here? I was like, that seems real pie in the sky. But I do think, you know, this was kind of the first big decision for Ishbia. I mean, obviously there was the Durant trade, which he played a role in, but you know, he really had his fingerprints all over this in terms of firing Monty. Who are they going to come up with next? I think was huge here. And you mentioned Kevin Young. I wonder, and I'm sure we'll get to this a little bit. Again, he's a great name that people talk about in NBA circles quite a bit, and seems to be a favorite of the players.
Just real quick, Nick Nurse was in that mix too. Mm-hmm. Like Nick Nurse seemed to really want Philadelphia. I don't know exactly how it would have played out if Nick Nurse had said, I want that job, but I just think Nick Nurse was someone that Phoenix was really interested in.
Interesting.
They were really interested in.
Very interesting. I wonder if there's a small part of the Suns who saw Mazzulla kind of have an up and down year and say, maybe we need to go with someone with more experience. I'll say this. I think this was the right move for them. Vogel has won a championship. That gives him built-in credibility and respect from the guys on the roster. And as you mentioned, he's had success in practically every stop he's went to, except Orlando, which has just kind of become a coach's wasteland. So I think it's a great hire. I think they made the right move by going with a veteran coach because, as you mentioned, the roster's in flux. This is not going to be, as great as Kevin Durant and Devin Booker are, this is not going to be a very easy kind of build-out for the Suns. And I don't think you introduce kind of the uncertainty of a young coach, even though Kevin Young may have great potential. I don't know that you introduce that uncertainty going with kind of the proven commodity that Frank Vogel is. I think that's a no-brainer decision.
Yeah, it gets reportedly a 5-year deal worth around $30 million. Well, so
he's got to get Monty Williams' agent, though.
Probably. I'm trying to remember who Frank Vogel. No, he doesn't have Monty Williams' agent. But there's like three coaching agents out there. So they all
he got the half Monty. Is what he got.
Well, you kind of had to give that money to Monty Williams because I think he had two or three years left on his contract at big numbers. So there's no incentive for Monty Williams to take a rebuilding job in Detroit for less than a big dollar figure. And look, I credit Detroit for doing that, for going out and signing Monty Williams, because you need someone that is going to be a leader in that locker room. Mm-hmm. You need someone that's going to be committed to player development. And look, it's been a lifetime since Monty Williams was in New Orleans, but it was Monty Williams that kind of started to build the Anthony Davis-led Pelicans into a playoff team. And he deserves a lot of credit for what he accomplished there. So I'd like the hire. It's a boatload of money, but as I always say, Rohan, these guys, they're made of money. All right. If ever an NBA owner says it's too much, I don't want to spend this much, just sell for $3 billion,
right?
At least, probably more for some of these franchises. So, yeah, good for Monty Williams. I think it's the right hire. in Detroit. Vogel's going to walk into a place, though, with a lot of pressure because the window to win in Phoenix is like 2 years, really. I mean, Durant eventually is going to hit a wall. Chris Paul is either going to be a shell of himself or gone. They don't have draft capital, so it's going to be problematic adding to that team with young pieces. He's, you know, to me, it's like 2 years. Like, this was a year I think Phoenix kind of blew it because, you know, we don't need to revisit this, but I just didn't think they needed to go all in for Kevin Durant in the moment, and they gave up a lot, maybe too much, to go and get him. But this was one of the 3 years they had, I thought, to win a championship. They didn't do it this year. Now I think they get two more before we're talking about Durant not being, you know, the number one or even the number two guy on a team that can beat a Denver in the West or a Memphis in the West if they can keep their stuff together, which is a nice segue to talk about something Adam Silver brought up at his press conference, which is Ja Morant. Now, Ja Morant is about a few weeks removed from the incident where he was caught brandishing a gun on Instagram Live. It was the second time in 3 months that Ja Morant was caught brandishing a gun on Instagram Live. He was suspended by the Memphis Grizzlies from all team activities, whatever that means, and he was under investigation by the NBA. So Adam Silver was asked about this before Thursday's game one, and he effectively said he'd made a decision, that they had done their homework, they'd figured things out.
Uncovered a lot of additional information, I believe.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm curious, though, what the additional information is. What's present to the naked eye is enough. He's carrying a gun, and he's doing it on Instagram Live. Like, this is exactly what he got punished for the last time around. Adam Silver basically said they're going to wait till after the finals to reveal the punishment, which, again, I think is a smart move. Like, this series has already been overshadowed by, you know, talk of disrespect and other teams, you know, being talked about more. If Adam Silver announces, and let's just say it's a 30-game suspension for Ja Morant, if Adam Silver announces that on Monday morning after game two, the rest of the week is going to be about Ja Morant. Mm-hmm. You won't be able to turn on ESPN or FS1 or sports talk radio across the country without seeing the hosts of these shows talking about Ja Morant. So I get it. Adam Silver wants to keep the focus on the product. It is a very good series on paper. He wants to keep the focus there. But, you know, when I was listening to Adam Silver and talking to a few people in league circles afterwards, I think this is going to be a big-time suspension. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to get in excess of 25 games. That, to me, is the bar for this. And we could be talking about 30, 35, even 40 games for Ja Morant. I thought Silver said something in a long string of comments about this where he said, we just don't know what it's going to take for Ja Morant to realize what he's doing is in error. I think Adam Silver's going to test that. I think he's going to slap Morant with one of the most significant punishments that he's ever slapped any player with. And it sure sounds like, Rohan, that he's involving the players' union in all this. He mentioned the head of the players' union as being part of this process. So this is being done kind of in, you know, with not in conjunction, because the union can't really advise Silver on that, but also with them being brought along every step of the way. So I can't, you know, I get asked a lot, like, what the number's going to be. I can't put my finger on it. I just think it's going to be big. I think it's going to be really big, and you're not going to see Ja Morant in a Grizzlies uniform maybe until the beginning of 2024. You know, maybe whatever number of games that suspension is, maybe you don't see him until very late 2023 or early 2024.
Yeah, you know, another thing that I thought was very interesting from that press conference, along the lines of what you mentioned, I think somebody asked Adam Silver, was his initial suspension enough? You know, because his initial suspension by the league after the first incident was a little strange. It was 8 games, but it was retroactive, so some time he missed, so he ended up coming back very quickly, and there was also confusion as to, did he actually, you know, how long was he in counseling for, etc., all these kind of different things that people were wondering during his initial suspension. And I have to wonder how much of this, I'm not saying Adam Silver is going to make a personal decision, but I think Adam Silver has a right to be kind of, I don't know if embarrassed is the right word or the right connotation, but a little bit like, hey, in a way, I put my reputation on the line for you by giving you this kind of meager suspension the first time, trusting that you aren't going to do this again, trusting that as one of the faces of the league, you kind of won't let me down, because I think a lot of people were expecting maybe something harsher the first time around. So, which is another reason why I think this time, I don't think Silver is going to be, you know, let himself get caught with an egg on his face twice. I think this time it's going to be significant. I think it should be significant. It is kind of crazy. I got to be honest. Like, it sounds like it was such a big focus of the press conference. I was not thinking going into that Silver press conference, like, oh, someone's going to ask about Morant. Like, I had kind of forgotten about it just because of the NBA playoffs. So I am glad also Silver is waiting, because it hasn't been on my mind, and it's not something I really would like to discuss, obviously, for many reasons during the finals. So I have to imagine it's going to be significant after the way he kind of, I think Silver went out on a limb for him, and Morant kind of let him down.
I mean, I was there to ask about the altitude Comcast dispute. So, you know,
yeah.
Fortunately, somebody beat me to it, right. But that was what was in front of my mind. Look, I've said this before and it still stands. I believe the NBA's feeling on the initial suspension was that they showed Ja Morant compassion.
Mm-hmm.
They cut him a break. They looked him in the eye in New York and believed him when he said he was dealing with anxiety issues, mental health issues, and they showed him compassion. And I also believe that there was a significant level of outrage in the league office when they saw less than 2 months later, Ja Morant back doing the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they know if what they're about to do is going to be effective. I don't think they know that. I do think they believe it's the only option for them at this point. People can talk about the legality of the gun rights. That's not at issue here. The NBA is a brand. Mm-hmm. And the NBA is not going to allow its brand to be tarnished by an image of a player holding a gun. You know, you could do whatever you want legally in whatever state, you know, allows guns in this country. If you want to play for the NBA and earn that money, you can't do it.
You know, he also had a couple weeks ago, you know, there was a wellness check. People were concerned about some Instagram posts. Like, there seems to be a lot going on there. I'm with you. It's tough. You know, the Grizzlies are in this position where organizations sometimes almost have to enable players to an extent, because of the NBA is such a player-driven league. We've seen more player movement now than ever, that franchises in many ways cater to stars more than they ever have before. And again, I'm not saying that means it's the Grizzlies' fault, or it's just there are so many factors at play here that could make someone feel, you know, and I'm not confident that Ja Morant feels this way, but there are factors at play that can make people feel untouchable, kind of above reproach, above punishment. That, you know, I'm just hopeful that whatever the NBA decides to do works, because not only is Ja such an exciting player, I'm not the first person, he's so important, just kind of the future of stardom in the NBA, that he does need to figure this out.
Yeah, one way or the other. I do think ultimately, if you listen to Adam Silver, it sure sounds like there's going to be something significant coming his way in terms of a suspension beginning next season. All right, last thing I want to talk to you about. Brad Stevens, the president of basketball operations in Boston, he held his end-of-season media availability, and not surprisingly, he confirmed that Joe Mazzulla would be back as the head coach. I support this decision, Rohan. I think that while Joe Mazzulla has had some flaws during the season, he still is a good coach with an incredibly high ceiling. He is a 34-year-old coach that was thrust into a very difficult situation just days before the start of training camp. And because of the brain drain on Boston's bench with the exit of Ime Udoka, Will Hardy, and later Damon Stoudemire, none of whom were replaced, that situation got even more difficult. And Joe Mazzulla got them to within one game of getting back to the NBA Finals. So you can micromanage that and look at it in different ways. You know, they were down 3-0, they had a Herculean comeback, but they were still one game away from you know, completing that great comeback. I'm expecting, you know, I've written this before. Steven Silas, I believe, is going to be on that bench next year. He's a no-brainer to be an assistant coach on Joe Mazzulla's staff. I thought Frank Vogel would be a candidate before Vogel got this job in Phoenix. But there are other guys that are, you know, Vogel-esque former head coaches with experience. Terry Stotts is out there. You've got James Borrego that's out there. These are coaches that can bring valuable
experience. Terry Stotts still out there? Terry Stotts a good coach.
Didn't go – the ending in Portland didn't go all that well.
Yeah.
didn't go out with a blaze of glory, so to speak. I wasn't surprised by any of that. The question now becomes, does Boston need to make any substantive changes? You know, Jaylen Brown, we can talk in circles about Jaylen Brown, but the Celtics are going to offer him at or close to the Supermax, and Jaylen Brown is going to accept it. These are facts. Like, the Celtics, you're not going to play games with Jaylen Brown, not in a league where, you know, you talk about $50, $60 million salary. How many guys in 5 years are going to be making $50, $60 million? The way the NBA is going, like this, the numbers just skyrocketing, TV money skyrocketing. So Jaylen Brown is not going to be this outlier out there making $50, $60 million. Might he be a little bit overpaid? Maybe. But before this, he was underpaid. So it all kind of balances out, you know, in the end. I think their questions are going to come on the periphery. You've got Grant Williams, who's going to be a free agent. You've got to make a decision there. They couldn't agree to contract terms last fall. Are they able to come together on terms now? And they've got to get front court help. Like you saw in the playoffs, you know, Al Horford, still an effective player, but
maybe not a 35-minute player.
Yeah, not as reliable as he used to be, especially offensively. Rob Williams kind of is what he is. He's a weak side shot blocker, linchpin defense. He can catch lobs, but that's always what he's going to be. I thought what hurt the Celtics in the series, what made me think back, was how they passed on a chance to get Jakob Poeltl at the deadline. When they were talking to San Antonio about Jakob Poeltl, they were in line with kind of the players it would take, but the Spurs wanted two first-round picks back from Boston. The Celtics stopped at one. And when Toronto, which ultimately got Jakob Poeltl, when they stopped at one, what the Spurs did was say, they made a judgment. It's like, all right, well, Toronto's pick is going to be better than yours, so we're going to take, you know, the Raptors' first-round pick. In hindsight, should the Celtics have given up that second first-round pick to get Jakob Poeltl? I know we're talking about, you know, a role player, someone that probably wouldn't be in the starting lineup, but would Jakob Poeltl have made a difference in that series? Maybe. You know, maybe. Yeah. Certainly more than Mike Muscala and Luke Kornet, who didn't get off the bench for real minutes. So, you know, that's the big thing. I think you make a decision on Grant Williams and you figure out a way to beef up that front court, because you just can't go into next year with 37-year-old Al Horford and perpetually injured Rob Williams as your two anchors there. It just won't work.
I agree. One thing I'll say about Mazzulla, by the way, who I did think proved to be a good coach, and after I got on this podcast and said they probably should move on, I looked like the biggest idiot. I will say that it's interesting, because while I believe in his potential as a coach, he needs to realize it fast enough for this team that is built to win now. I do think that they are going to need to obviously tweak the rotation. You mentioned it. Al Horford just looked so much older by the end of this playoff run. You know, they signed him to the extension. His salary is coming down quite a bit, but I think it's going to be in line with the kind of player he is at this stage in his career. Rob, I'm not sure they can trust. It's funny, their front court looked like such a strength at July last year when they signed Danilo Gallinari. Grant was coming off this incredible playoff run.
They're counting on Gallinari. Like, they're going to count on Gallinari next year. They're hoping he opts in, and they're counting on him to be a player in that rotation next year.
Right, and so I think if they can rebuild it a little bit, you know, they do have pieces to move. It just decides that what they want to do around Jason and Jaylen, which I agree, you keep those two together. We're probably going to hear Smart's name come up at some point. You have to imagine maybe they'll think about Brogdon, just because those are tradable contracts that can bring back impactful players. You're going to have to consider it. But I agree. This team is close. Okay, they're very close. They've made so many conference finals. Jason Tatum is at the very early beginning of his prime. I think he still has another level to get to as a player. So
I think Jaylen Brown has another level because he keeps going to other levels. Like, he was all NBA for the first time this year. Is there another level? I don't know. This might be the plateau, but at the same time, Jaylen Brown is going to go into the offseason and work on his ball handling.
Right.
That was a problem this year. Caleb Martin on some interview.
It's on the Levitard show.
Yeah,
players got to stop going on Levitard, man. They keep.
He's like, was the plan to force him left? It's always to force him left.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, but like Jalen's going to get better at that. Jaylen works.
Right.
He's going to identify weaknesses and he's going to get better. It's a no-brainer to give him, you know, whatever contract you have to give him to keep him in Boston and. Yeah, and just go around the edges. I don't think this is a team that needs to make any substantive change. And by the way, like the teams we're watching in the finals, particularly Denver, are proof of that. Like,
right.
Don't panic when things go wrong. You know, Michael Malone, you know, might have been fired a few years ago by other teams. You know, Jamal Murray, would teams have been so trustworthy of his ability to come back and be the second option that he's become? Michael Porter Jr., I still think it was a little crazy of the Denver to give him the money they did when they did it, but you know, they invested in him, and as long as that back holds up, he's going to be a 3 or a 2A option on that team. So have a little bit of patience. I know it sucks that they've been to 4 conference finals, 1 NBA finals, but I think you have to have a little bit of patience in Boston and let them keep growing together. And they took a step back because they had to change coaches. That changed everything up. And Mazzulla will now have to grow with this team, but I wouldn't do anything major to change it up in Boston.
Listen, if Miami can run it back with the group they ran it back with and make the finals, again, I think this will be an outlier. But that if you ever need a reason to not overreact, it's that. And I think Boston's set up pretty well.
Exactly. All right, we will be back early next week. I will be at Game 2 at Ball Arena on Sunday, and Rohan will be taking over on-site coverage when the series shifts back to Miami on Wednesday. Rohan, good stuff, man. We will do it again next week.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Medical Mutual wants to remind you it's almost time for Medicare's annual enrollment period. As a trusted health insurer for more than 90 years, Medical Mutual is here to help you find better Medicare benefits. Be confident you're getting the most from your Medicare Advantage plan. Schedule your free Medicare plan review today at medmutual.com/review. Medical Mutual, Ohio's hometown Medicare insurer.